I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
On UNRWA, we were deeply concerned by the allegations that were made about the participation or involvement of some of its employees in October 7th.
UNRWA is in crisis after donor countries cut funding following Israeli allegations against the UN agency without providing evidence. Amid a humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, we'll speak with former UNRWA spokesperson Chris Gunness. Then, Senegal is in the midst of its worst political upheaval in decades after the president postponed this month's election. We'll get the latest. And Io Capitano, a new Oscar-nominated film follows young Senegalese migrants on their journey from West Africa to Italy.
If you pile up the boat, you can both leave for the price of one.
I've never done that. I don't even know how to swim. You want to let us die here, in the middle of the sea?
We'll speak with the filmmaker and the Senegalese man whom the film is based on. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected a proposal by Hamas for a three-phase ceasefire where Hamas would release all hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. Hamas is seeking an end to the Israeli assault and for all Israeli troops to leave Gaza. On Wednesday, Netanyahu said the war on Gaza would continue and ordered Israeli forces to prepare to attack the southern city of Rafah.
I would like to emphasize again that there is no solution other than total victory.
At a news conference yesterday, released hostages pleaded with Netanyahu to prioritize the release of remaining captives in Gaza. This is Adina Moshe, a 72-year-old grandmother who'd been held hostage in Gaza for 49 days.
I'm very afraid that if you continue on this path to dismantle Hamas, there will be no more hostages to release.
Despite Netanyahu's vow to continue the assault on Gaza, truce negotiations are continuing. A Hamas delegation is in Cairo today for talks with mediators from Egypt and Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has wrapped up his Middle East trip after visiting Israel and the occupied West Bank, where he was met by Palestinian protesters. Health officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks since October 7th have now brought the death toll to nearly 28,000. This comes as the U.N. is warning the risk of famine in Gaza is, quote, increasing by the day. The Palestine Red Crescent Society says they still have no news about six-year-old Hind and two of the group's rescue workers who disappeared 10 days ago while attempting to reach her. The child was last heard from while in a car which came under attack by Israeli fire. Six of her relatives were killed while in the vehicle. Hind's mother spoke out this week, imploring international actors to help locate her missing child.
Every second I wait for my daughter. If we hear an ambulance, we think it's Hind. If we hear people coming over, we think it's Hind. Every crash, every gunshot, every bombing, every missile I hear, I think if it's happening next to my daughter or directly to her or to the medics that went to her.
Earlier today, the Palestine Red Crescent Society said another member of its rescue team, Mohammed Al-Omari, was killed, bringing the total number of its aid workers killed by Israel's attacks to 12. Meanwhile, the family of a Palestinian-American woman is calling on U.S. officials to help free Samahir Ismail after she was forcibly taken from her home by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank in the middle of the night Monday. Ismail is a resident of Louisiana. Her Congress member, Troy Carter, said Tuesday he's contacted the U.S. Embassy and the State Department in hopes of securing her release. In news from Iraq, the United States has assassinated a senior commander of Kataib Hezbollah militia. A U.S. drone attack in Baghdad reportedly killed Abu Bakr al-Sadi and two other members of the Iran-aligned group, which the U.S. believes was involved in the recent drone strike on a base in Jordan that killed three American troops. The government of Iraq condemned the U.S. drone strike as a, quote, clear aggression and violation of Iraqi sovereignty. Meanwhile, Israel attacked the Syrian city of Homs on Tuesday. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the attack killed 10 people, including at least six civilians. In other news from the region, Saudi Arabia has reaffirmed it will not establish diplomatic relations with Israel until an independent Palestinian state is recognized. Protests against the war are continuing throughout the U.S. Here in New York, at least 100 Jewish American activists and their allies were arrested Wednesday as they blockaded a road on President Biden's motorcade route as he attended fundraisers. In Chicago, 33 people were arrested as they blocked entrances to the Woodward manufacturing plant, which makes military equipment that has been used by Israel in Palestine. In California, Code Pink and other activists blocked an entrance to the Travis Air Force Base in Fairfield.
It's our responsibility when our government is so horrendously breaking international laws to step up and say no. Not in our name, not with our tax dollars. No weapons to Israel.
Code Pink activists who were arrested during a previous action at the Travis base will be arraigned later this month. The Senate adjourned Wednesday after failing to advance the contentious $118 billion border package. Republicans, who demanded the hardline immigration measure in exchange for funding for Ukraine and Israel, U-turned on the bill after Donald Trump directed them to reject it. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer slammed Republicans and Trump for sowing chaos in legislative business.
There's one other person besides Donald Trump who is rooting for chaos in the Senate. It is Vladimir Putin. If we fail in this moment, if we abandon our friends in Ukraine to Vladimir Putin, history will cast a shameful and permanent shadow on senators who block funding. It is a matter of the highest national urgency that we get this right.
Schumer said he would call a separate vote today on military funding for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan without any border provisions. As the $118 billion border bill failed Wednesday, more than 800 faith leaders and groups called on Congress to pivot to a more humane immigration package, quote, that respects the sacred dignity of all people. President Biden is sending a delegation to the swing state of Michigan today to meet with Arab and Muslim leaders amid growing opposition to U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza and to Biden's candidacy. Dearborn Mayor Abdullah Hamoud, who previously refused to meet with Biden's campaign manager, announced Wednesday he's joining over 30 other Michigan officials who are vowing to cast an uncommitted vote in the state's primary on February 27th. The effort is being led by the group Listen to Michigan, which is headed by Congressmember Rashida Tlaib's sister, Leila El-Abid. In other election news, Democrat Marianne Williamson has suspended her presidential campaign against Joe Biden. Pakistan cut off cell phone and internet service earlier today, just as voting began in a national election marred by controversy. Opposition candidates say the telecommunications cutoff is just the latest move by Pakistan's military-backed interim government to rig the election. Pakistan's Interior Ministry said the move was needed to, quote, mitigate potential security threats. On Wednesday, a pair of bombings outside campaign offices in the province of Balochistan killed 30 people. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, tens of thousands of people continue to flee violence in the east of the country as M23 rebels advance toward Goma, the capital of North Kivu. M23, which is accused of having ties with Rwanda, reportedly surrounded the city of Sake, considered the last line of defense before reaching Goma. Many in eastern Congo have been forced to flee multiple times amid mounting violence from some 120 armed groups that operate in the region. This is an internally displaced person.
There was a lot of gunfire at home. The M23 had arrived burning the houses. They made us give them all the money. Some of us even lost our children. There were many dead and wounded. When they entered a house, they took everything, killed people, and took away livestock. That's what made us flee from our home to here in Sake. At the beginning of last week, we fled from Shonga to Kirosha, and it was on Sunday that we left Kirosha to come here.
During a soccer match this week at the Africa Cup of Nations, the DRC's national team sought to bring attention to the largely ignored humanitarian disaster back home. Players held one hand in front of their mouths while pointing two fingers to their temples during Congo's national anthem. The Environmental Protection Agency announced its tightening regulations on soot. Breathing in excess fine particulate matter can lead to asthma attacks, cancer, and heart and lung disease. It's been linked to anywhere from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of premature deaths in the U.S. per year. The new rule will lower the amount of allowed fine particulate matter in the air from 12 micrograms per cubic meter to 9 micrograms. And scientists from the European Union say average global temperatures over the past 12 months exceeded 1.5 Celsius above pre-industrial levels for the first time, marking a grim new milestone in the climate crisis. Scientists say last month was the hottest January ever recorded. Temperature records have now been broken for 8 months in a row. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh, joined by Amy Goodman. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Nermeen, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Fears are growing in Rafah over an imminent Israeli ground invasion after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected a Hamas proposal for a ceasefire on Wednesday and ordered the military to attack the southernmost city in the territory. Over 1.2 million Palestinians are sheltering in Rafah after being displaced in the Israeli assault. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said a ground invasion of Rafah would, quote, exponentially increase what is already a humanitarian nightmare with untold regional consequences, he said. Aid agencies are warning of famine amid profound food shortages, with a quarter of a million people in Gaza already starving. The healthcare system has collapsed, and the lack of water and sanitation has prompted outbreaks of illness and disease. Most of the residents in Gaza have been internally displaced, with more than half the population sheltering in facilities run by UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Despite being the largest humanitarian agency in Gaza, UNRWA says it may run out of funds by the end of the month after at least 18 states or institutions, including many of the agency's biggest funders, announced they were suspending their donations last month. The cuts came after the Israeli government accused several UNRWA employees of participating in the Hamas attack on October 7th. Israel made the allegations in a document it provided to foreign governments, which apparently contained no direct evidence of the claims. Several news outlets, including Britain's Channel 4, the Financial Times, and Sky News, have all reported the document provided no evidence to support the conclusions that the agency's staff were involved in the October 7th attacks. Meanwhile, Australia's foreign minister said today she did not have all the evidence about the allegations and that she was working to bring an end to the suspension of funds. The government of Canada has also not seen any evidence to back up Israel's claim, according to CBC News. UNRWA is set to lose $65 million in funding by the end of February as a result of the cuts, according to the New York Times. The agency relies on government contributions to fund its operations in occupied Palestine, as well as in Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. For more, we're joined in London by the former spokesperson for UNRWA, Chris Gunness. He's now the director of the Myanmar Accountability Project. Chris Gunness, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could begin by responding to this news about UNRWA possibly running out of funds by the end of this month, losing $65 million.
It's extremely sad and it's extremely regrettable because UNRWA wants nothing more than to work, as it's done for decades, with its donors in a very cooperative relationship to restore funding. UNRWA has taken robust and resolute action. The Commissioner General, Philippe Lazzarini, sacked these workers even before the external investigation and the internal, the OIOS report in New York, even before that had barely started. This was resolute action as part of a zero tolerance policy. And it's with regret I say that I hope that the donors get onto the right side of history and get onto the right side of humanitarian principles and international humanitarian law. And I say with regret that it's possible, at least, that even the Genocide Convention, which calls on state parties, including most of these defunders, to prevent genocide. And what is happening is that this starvation, which the UN correctly says is breaking out, the UN assesses that it's possible that more people will die of starvation than the actual military assault. So it's with great regret I say the donors need to come back into the fold. And just, if I can give you just one example, we're seeing in the New York Times these appalling pictures of these Abu Ghraib-style humiliating actions by individual Israeli soldiers. Will American officials, will American audiences judge the Israeli army by the action of a few? No. It will judge the Israeli army by the response of the Israeli army to these appalling, appalling images. And I say that is the basis upon which UNRWA should be judged, not the actions which remain entirely unproven, as we now stand, against a few bad apples. It must judge the agency by how it responds. How has the agency responded? With robust and resolute and swift action as part of zero tolerance policy that is inculcated in the agency, and it's been done in partnership with the donors. This is a failure, not of UNRWA. If it's a failure, it's a failure of the donor community as well that's been working so closely. And even Mr. Blinken, the UN Secretary of State, has said that the Americans have not been able independently to corroborate this evidence of the what I'm calling and what is now established in the international discourse, the dodgy dossier. That's a reference to the dossier, the intelligence dossier, upon which Mr. Blair, former British Prime Minister, took Britain to war in Iraq. It was a dodgy dossier. Do the donors want to be judged by history as potentially adding to a starvation, complicity potentially with the genocide, against the crime of crimes, genocide? No, they need to come back onto the right side of history and of the law and of humanitarian principles and immediately resume the funding of UNRWA. That's the logical, that's the humane, that's the compassionate thing for the donors to do.
Chris Gunness, can you talk about what UNRWA does, how large it is? And I mean, you talk about this Israeli dossier. We just saw CBC said the Canadian government hasn't seen the evidence of this. The U.S. government says they haven't seen actually the evidence, where they're talking about something like 9 or 12 UNRWA employees of what? 13,000 in Gaza, over 30,000 overall. Talk about the history of UNRWA.
I think it's important in conceiving of UNRWA, both historically and its activities today, to think of it not as an aid agency, but as a government. So UNRWA runs in Syria, Jordan, West Bank, Gaza and Lebanon schools, 550 schools, sorry, schools for 550,000 students. UNRWA's primary health clinics have 7 million patient visits a year. UNRWA has nearly 2 million food recipients across the region. That's the core budget. That's the education, relief and social services, and the primary health. As well as that, UNRWA has emergency programs. So UNRWA does these core services, education, health, relief and social services for as many as 6 million Palestine refugees across the region in some of the most vulnerable, isolated, fragile communities. But when emergencies happen, for example, the Gaza war, UNRWA has to keep these life-saving, regionally stabilizing services ticking over while it turns to the emergency. And that's what it's done historically. It became operational on the ground in May 1950. And as its title suggests, it did relief, humanitarian relief for the 750,000 people who fled or were forced from their homes fleeing the 1948 war. And it also did works. It did job creation programs, if you like. But when it became apparent that the Israeli government was not going to grant them what the Universal Declaration grants all people, which is the right to return home, UNRWA then realized that it had a huge refugee population whose children needed education, that needed primary health, that needed all sorts of services. So UNRWA gradually grew in response to the humanitarian need of the refugees that UNRWA was serving. Cut to today, huge education program. That's the biggest program. And by the way, offering children around the Middle East an escape from their the drudgery and the isolation, the vulnerability, the fragility, the marginalization, and offering them the chance to be citizens of the world, to put their refugee status behind them rather than perpetuating this refugee status, which, you know, that's an accusation that's often thoughtlessly thrown at UNRWA. UNRWA offers refugees an escape from that narrative and that kind of life, which is why it is such a tragedy that, based on a dodgy Israeli dossier, this huge existential crisis has been triggered within UNRWA, perhaps the worst in its history. And the donors have become complicit, as Penny Wong, the Australian foreign minister, has said, as you've just quoted in the news. She hasn't seen the evidence. No donor has seen the evidence, because as of now, the evidence simply does not exist. There's nothing that links these dozen or so former UNRWA workers, and I stress the word former, with the alleged crimes. So let's get the funding resumed. Let's avoid a humanitarian, a mass starvation. And to be clear, starvation is a massacre in slow motion. And that slow motion massacre has already begun. The donors need to realise the enormity of what they've unleashed and come back immediately into the fold, where UNRWA will embrace them and will work with them to deal with these issues, as it has always done throughout its history.
I wanted to go to the news conference that Secretary of State Tony Blinken held yesterday in Tel Aviv. A few journalists got to ask questions, and this was the question on UNRWA.
On UNRWA, look, we were deeply concerned by the allegations that were made about the participation or involvement of some of its employees in October 7th. And it's imperative that, as the UN has said it's doing, that there be a thorough investigation, that there be clear accountability, and that there be clear measures put in place to make sure that this can't happen again, that personnel working for it were not in any way involved in terrorism or the events of October 7th. We know that the work that UNRWA performs, the functions that it performs, have to be preserved because so many lives are depending on it.
And I wanted to go back to Washington, D.C., where Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House press spokesperson, was asked about the fact that Channel 4, Sky News, and the Financial Times found no evidence of UNRWA involvement in the October 7th Hamas attack.
One more question on Gaza. Did the White House receive an ironclad evidence that actually the UNRWA staff member, 12 of them, were involved in the October 7th attack? Because four news organizations, including Financial Times, Channel 4, and Sky News, found no evidence to support the Israeli claim. They said actually what they provided was just cell phone messages and cards that had been found after
UNRWA
went
to
this. Yes.
Well,
Where are you in the process of reviewing that? And second, considering the disaster humanitarian situation in Gaza, what's the alternative if you're waiting for the results to come out or the review to come out?
As you know, there's an investigation happening, so we're going to let that investigation move forward. And look, funding for Palestinian civilians is a team effort. And so, for example, while we continue to provide funding to organizations like WFP, other countries may continue to fund UNRWA, which is their own sovereign decision. That is their right.
So that's Karine Jean-Pierre saying that they think that they're continuing the investigation, yet they've already cut the funding. Meanwhile, Australia, who did also defund, says They are now reevaluating. Chris Gunness, you have called the cutting of aid to UNRWA, the U.S. most important, overwhelmingly gives more than any other country, immoral and illegal. Why illegal?
Because it's very clear that international humanitarian law, which expressly prohibits the use of humanitarian aid, food aid, as a political weapon. And the Genocide Convention makes it an obligation on state parties to prevent genocide. And if you don't prevent genocide, then you are guilty of violating the convention. And the fact that mass starvation is already breaking out suggests that the Genocide Convention is being violated. But if I may, Amy, just return to some of the things Mr. Blinken said. Notice, I mean, let's be forensic about this. He used the word allegation, not evidence. Now, there is a vast gaping gap between allegations, which anyone can make, frankly, and evidence, which needs to be corroborated. And the fact that the American intelligence services, the best, allegedly, certainly the best resourced, I should say, in the world, has not been able independently to corroborate this information, which has triggered this huge crisis. That is, I think, very, very revealing. It's also revealing, incidentally, at the end of that soundbite, you heard that Mr. Blinken saying UNRWA's work is indispensable. And I think we can talk about this whole idea of replacing UNRWA. But you heard the spokeswoman talking about accountability. Well, let's look at what UNRWA's done. Even before the internal UN at the highest level investigation had barely started, and certainly before the external investigation had barely started, UNRWA took robust action against this. It has in place, and it's worked for years with the donors, accountability frameworks and mechanisms. Staff are screened. The very fact the Israelis know these names is because UNRWA, as part of the zero tolerance policy and its commitment to neutrality, passed on to the Israelis last May, let's be precise, the entire staff list of UNRWA in Gaza and the West Bank in digital form to the Israelis. It had already been run through the Security Council's terrorism list, and Israel didn't come back with a single complaint. It was only until after the ICJ ruling, the day after the ICJ ruling accusing Israel of plausible genocide, and the headlines were, we all saw them, that the Israelis leaked this. So what I would say is the news management is unravelling. It's been exposed. And what we're now seeing is the spotlight turning to the donors. And I would like to see some proper investigation into the frameworks that are there for the donors who are accusing UNRWA of politicisation. I would like to say, what are the donors doing in a way which is accountable and which is transparent, to show to the world how they ring-fenced their humanitarian decision-making process and to keep it immune from politics? Because they're accusing UNRWA of politicising, weaponising. You know, there's all this accusations around UNRWA's neutrality. What about the donor neutrality? Because it looks increasingly as if the donor community, based on a very dodgy dossier, was doing Israel's political bidding. We heard Mr. Netanyahu, we've heard him say several times that he would like to see UNRWA destroyed, dismantled. And it looks horribly, and I say this with deep regret, that the donors are, on the face of it, going along with that Israeli scheme to dismantle UNRWA, which is what I say, they can reverse that. They can reverse that this moment by coming back and saying, it was a dodgy dossier and we don't have the facts. They're now openly saying they don't have the facts. They need to come back and acknowledge what is actually happening. It was a piece of news management. Treachery happens in wars. It happens, you know, that's what goes on. Misinformation, lies, the truth is the first casualty for all of that. That's what's happened here. The truth appears to have been the first casualty. The donors have made this precipitous, regrettable, I would say illegal and disproportionate decision to defund UNRWA. That can be reversed immediately by the donors coming back. And I would urge them to do this because, you know, judge UNRWA by its response. Just as I say, judge the IDF, I say to American audiences, judge the IDF by its response to these Abu Ghraib pictures. Judge UNRWA by its response. Commissioner General Lazzarini has been swift and resolute as part of a zero-tolerance policy, which, by the way, has worked throughout the region. Do you really think that 33,000 UNRWA workers could be actively doing this humanitarian, human development work across the region if it weren't implementing policies which were absolutely impartial? There's no question that UNRWA would very quickly lose the trust of the communities and the donors if they weren't implementing this zero-tolerance policy. And that has to be recognised. It's the response of UNRWA that donors need to respond to, not a few bad
Chris
apples.
Chris Gunness, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Chris Gunness, the former spokesperson for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA. He's now the director of the Myanmar Accountability Project. When we come back, Senegal is in the midst of its worst political upheaval in decades after the president postponed this month's election. We'll get the latest. Stay with us.